Area Voices tells the arts, culture, and history stories of northern Minnesota. This Monday, Red Lake and Pembina Band Ojibwe gathered at Maple Lake for a day of ceremony, connection, and community in the name of the Old Crossing Treaty of 1863. Bob Schimmick is a longtime treaty rights advocate, and he's on the phone to tell us more about treaties in general, the Old Crossing Treaty of 1863, and of course he's going to tell us about what happened on Monday. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Maggie. Thank you for having me on the air.
Well, thank you for being here and taking the time to talk with us this morning. Before we get to the details of the actual Old Crossing Treaty of 1863, could you tell us a little bit about what treaties are and what they do in general?
Well, there were three different types of treaties that were negotiated here in the U.S. There were peace treaties, of which we had one that was subject to us in the Dakota back in 1825. There were land cession treaties where tribes sold land to the United States, and there were treaties that created reservations. So there was basically three different types. I think what's important today is, and we're, you know, we hear more and more about this here in the last 10 years or so, are these land cession treaties and, you know, what rights were retained under those treaties and what wasn't.
Right. And why is it important? I mean, you know, that kind of leads to the question of why it's important for both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to know about those treaties and understand them.
Well, you know, it says in the Constitution of the United States, you know, that treaties are the supreme law of the land. And, you know, there's some other language that surrounds that. But I think in the context of what's going on here in the Midwest, of course, one important aspect is without these land cession treaties, much of what's now Minnesota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, Michigan, as well as many other areas throughout the country could not legally exist without these treaties. I think the other thing that's important is these treaties are living documents. They're not some kind of a dusty thing you bring down off the shelf every 15 or 20 years and dust it off and say, oh, yeah, that was a good treaty or that was a bad treaty. No. If you're a citizen of the United States today, you are party to these treaties. And going back to that language in the Constitution of the United States, treaties are the supreme law of the land. We're all supposed to live by the same law, okay? We all have some responsibilities to each other, whether we like them or not, to uphold our responsibilities to each other that are dictated under the terms of these treaties. Congress did not just pass them and forget about them. Tribe did not just sign them and forget about them. They're very much living documents that essentially codified a way of life for both the Anishinaabeg, the Indian people, as well as giving the settlers, the colonists, you know, access to some land they wanted.
So tell us specifically about the Old Crossing Treaty of 1863.
Okay, well, it's an interesting study. You know, first of all, I would introduce it as, you know, saying it's probably one of the greatest land heists in all of the history of North America, in terms of the way things ended up. Not the way it started, but the way it ended up. Okay. So in the fall of 1863, September and October, Indian Commissioner Alexander Ramsay and his assistants and two companies of dragoons met chiefs, headmen, and band members from Red Lake and Pembina bands at the old crossing on the Red Lake River. And that, you know, that spot is today commemorated and memorialized by a park. It's southwest of Red Lake Falls. And, you know, there is the old crossing treaty park. You know, we were out there on Monday. So terms, conditions were negotiated over a number of weeks during those 2 months, and an agreement, a consensus, was arrived at by both sides. And the trick, one of the tricky parts of this whole treaty is, you know, when it talks about the land cession, it talks about, it says, all rights, title, and interest to the land described below. And then it gives this great big land description, which constitutes about 11 million acres of northwestern Minnesota.
That is huge.
Yeah, northeastern North Dakota. Basically the Red River Valley, the northern half of the Red River Valley. Anyway, that all rights, titles, and interests would be transferred to the United States. Okay. And, you know, if you take that at its face value, you would say, well, yeah, they sold it lock, stock, and barrel. But during those treaty negotiations, six different times, Alexander Ramsay made reference to and assured the Indians present at the negotiations that they would always be able to hunt, fish, and gather in their usual and various spots throughout the 11 million acres. So that's, you know, that's what they agreed to. And why that's important. Why that's important. And you know, we see this in the 1855 treaty. We see this in the 1854, the 1837. These are all treaties that involve Minnesota Chippewa hunting, fishing, gathering was retained because had the United States denied them the right and the opportunity to feed themselves, there would have been tens of thousands of starving Indians.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like what was written on the paper is not necessarily what was agreed to. It, you know, from this description, it just, and that the indigenous people at the time would never have agreed to it if it would have meant starving their people. So were there barriers? Were there language barriers and things that were allowing that kind of thing to happen?
Well, there's always that discussion around who the translators were and, you know, what was actually conferred, what was actually understood, were the translators accurate? I mean, you know, this happens kind of all across the board. Part of the issue here is Ojibwe-Mowin does not translate easily into English. So even with a translator, you know, there are some barriers, okay, just to try and, you know, make it come out right when you go from English to Ojibwe or Ojibwe to English. But yeah, you know, 1863, you know, most of the Anishinaabeg were, you know, they spoke our native language. They did not speak English. They did not speak French. You know, there was perhaps a few, but yeah, there were those barriers. But at the end of the day, there was agreement and there was understanding. You know, here's what we'll agree to. So, you know, when they touched pen to paper, both sides of it, the Ojibwe from Red Lake and Pembina Bands, and representatives of the United States of America, you know, they affirmed certain things. Yeah, we sold the land, you know, without a doubt. And there was money. There was some money that was supposed to go to the bands in compensation for the land. There were a few other provisions, but what's most important is what was not written in the treaty. And this is one of the things, you know, when you get into these court fights, which we're, you know, we're trying to avoid a whole bunch of that. But when you get into court with these kinds of issues, and because these treaties are negotiated in the context of international law, not necessarily United States law, not contract law, international law, one of the court tests, you know, has been and continues to be, well, if something isn't specifically enumerated as being sold, transferred, abolished, extinguished, or otherwise encumbered, it is retained.
Mm-hmm.
So we retain the rights to hunt, fish, and gather. We retain the rights to live out there. We retain the rights to travel out there. Mm-hmm. None of that was written down in the treaty as being transferred to the United States. We did not transfer those rights to the United States. And understand, you know, these are rights that are reserved for us, by us. These things, these weren't given by the United States. These were things that our ancestors knew we were going to need into the future.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I was just going to recap and just say that we're talking with Bob Shimmick, and Bob's a longtime treaty advocate and one of the organizers of an event that happened on Monday at Maple Lake in honor of this treaty that we're talking about, the Old Crossing Treaty of 1863. And I just wanted to ask if you could tell us about the day and the event that happened on Monday, if you could take us through that.
Okay, so I've been working on this off and on since, early last summer, nearly a year. shortly after the Herrera case ruled out of the Supreme Court in Wyoming. It was Wyoming versus Herrera. It had something to do with a Crow Indian from Montana shooting an elk on some National Forest Service land in Wyoming. So, you know, I worked on this 18555 issue for a while. And with the thought in mind, I got to get to this 1863. Well, it wasn't happening, and it wasn't happening. Then Herrera rolled out of the Supreme Court in favor of the Indians hunting, fishing, gathering, right? And I thought, okay, it's time. So then I, you know, earlier this year, before the sugar bush, you know, I kind of renewed the whole thought. What are we going to do? How are we going to do? When are we going to do it? And I looked at all the holidays, and I thought, well, so what about 4th of July? And I thought about that, and I said, no, no, no. What about Red Lake Independence Day, which is celebrated July 6th of each year? So that's the date we chose. And, you know, we notified all the appropriate officials, Red Lake Tribal Council, Turtle Mountain Tribal Council, the governor of Minnesota, the attorney general, the commissioner of the DNR. We just told everybody, hey, we're going to do this. We're going fishing as an exercise of our off-reservation hunting, fishing, and gathering rights reserved in the Treaty of 1863. we went down there this last Monday morning, the 6th, and started off with ceremony. Beautiful, beautiful ceremony. Talking through all these things, addressing all these different manitouk, all these different spirits that oversee and help take care of these things. And we addressed our ancestors and our commitment to renewing our effort to restore that which they reserved for us. Early in the ceremony, a couple of conservation officers from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources rolled up. They got out of their truck, and we were right in the middle of the ceremony, and they asked for me, and I just told them, wait, we're in the middle of something here. When we're done, then we'll talk. So they courteously and respectfully waited till we were done. And then we invited them into our circle and told them, okay, now we can conduct business. And this was during the feast part of it. So they came in and they said, well, we've come to issue you a permit for this activity you're doing today. And, there's always this question. Well, what do you do? Because the state of Minnesota really has no authority or jurisdiction over treaty rights. The only ones who really have that authority is the United States of America, the federal government. But we accepted the permit. And I must say, in my talks with all the state officials, they were courteous, they were respectful. It was a good exchange of information. Everybody learned a lot. So in the interest of keeping communications open and free, I accepted the permit. I thanked the officers for their time and their effort to come up. And we had our feast, and we went fishing. We set some nets. We set two nets in Maple Lake. And there was also a number of people who were fishing from the shore.
Mm-hmm. Did you catch anything? How was the fishing, I guess?
We caught nine. You know, it's a lake we're not familiar with, okay?
Right.
And so it was kind of a shot in the dark. Should we sit over here or over there? We checked some water depths and myself and, my fishing partner, Veronica Skinaway, she was the other one who was a big driver in all this. So anyway, she brought a net and a canoe, and she went out and set it in one place, and I went over in front of a number of McMansions and set mine. And we left them in for about an hour and a half or so, and then we picked them up, and we had nine fish, and, then we moved up to the Old Crossing Treaty Park on the Red Lake River for an afternoon of feasting, ceremony, celebration, and talking and exchanging information. And, why is this so important? Why is this so important that we reaffirm our commitment to a way of life that was codified in that very spot in the fall of 1863 that reserved a way of life for us, for the Anishinaabe. I truly believe that's what, you know, that's what these, that's what our ancestors were thinking about in these times. Remember, this is the fall of 1863. This is a year after the Little Crow War in southern Minnesota that culminated with the hanging of the 40 Sioux at Mankato. There were cavalry sweeping southern Minnesota, South Dakota, sweeping up and down the Red River Valley in the year afterwards, looking for the Sioux. So we knew very well what happened to the Sioux, you know, when they waged war against the United States. And when Alexander Ramsay showed up with two companies of dragoons, you know, they're soldiers, they're fighting men, and surrounded the camp where the negotiations were happening, you know, we didn't have much choice. We didn't have much alternative. We knew we couldn't win a war with them. So our ancestors did what they thought was right in reserving and codifying a way of life for all future Anishinaabe. So when we went out and set those nets that day, we were reaffirming that original affirmation that took place at the old crossing in the fall of 1863. You know, we're reconnecting, we're renewing our efforts, you know, we're making sure that we take care of the land, the water, the wildlife, in a way that's consistent with the values that our ancestors had when they reserved those things for us. And I think that's the important part of all this. Is there much places left to hunt, fish, and gather out there? No, not really. There's not much public land. Yeah, we could go hunting on federal, state, county land, but there's not much. We have to remember, this is the Red River Valley. Mm-hmm. Just about every square inch of it is farmed. But there is a fair amount of water out there. There are some lakes. There are some rivers. And my own personal commitment to this is about the water. It's about the water out there. It's about the fish out there. It's about the sturgeon out there that are really struggling to make their comeback. You know, amongst their people, we have sturgeon clan. Most people have never seen a sturgeon. Okay?
True.
So, you know, and one elder once told me at one point, he was Lynx clan, Bijou. He said, if the lynx go away, I cease to exist. That's the head of his clan, see? So the water needs healing. Our clans need healing. The sturgeon need to reoccupy their original areas, recolonize their territory, along with the Anishinaabe.
Bob Shimek, thank you so much for telling us about the action and the event that happened on Monday. We really appreciate you taking the time to educate us about the treaty and the concerns of all the people involved in this day.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the air, and you know, we'll continue to advance this issue and reaffirm. Have the other half of the negotiations reaffirm that these rights exist. We've done our part. So So now we have to address the United States of America.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Bob.
That is Bob Shimek, and this is Area Voices. It's made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.